Enjoy listening to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. We're going to spend the rest of this hour with somebody who understands this dynamic very well, because he himself has been in the middle of great controversy concerning Israel and Palestine, and that is Stephen Walt. And he got into this controversy many years ago with John Mearsheimer as co-author when they wrote the book The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. Stephen Walt now is the Robert and Renee Belfer Professor of International Relations at Harvard University. He's also the author of the book The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy. I spoke to him a couple of hours ago. Stephen Walt, thank you for your time.
Nice to be with you again.
One of the last times we had, I think we had you on to talk about your previous book, The Hell of Good Intentions, but I think the last time before that we had you on was back in 2014. This was sort of up until now the last time that there was a major bombardment of Gaza by Israel. It was considered at the time to be one of the bloodiest moments in the history of the conflict. Over 2,000 Palestinians had died. More than 10,000 people were injured. Of course, those numbers today are dramatically dwarfed. The reason we had you on in 2014, one of the reasons we had you on for 2014, was because we were struggling to get Democratic congressional lawmakers from the area where the show originates, who regularly come on our radio station to talk about this and to talk about their votes, including folks like Barbara Lee, who sort of name to fame came when she was the sole vote against authorizing the war on terrorism in 2001, to talk about her vote concerning her continued votes supporting Israeli military assistance. She would not come on to talk to us, neither would any of the other Democratic lawmakers at the time. She instead gave us a statement that said she would never support offensive measures. She was supporting the Iron Dome for Israel, which she called a defensive measure. And so here we are again in year 2023, and we are once again experiencing this same dynamic, not just Barbara Lee, Ro Khanna, somebody else who is frequently critical of U.S. foreign policy, will not come and talk to us about their votes when it comes to Israel. And I guess one can see why. The folks who have voted against the resolution in support of Israel are now facing primary challenges. Some members are even potentially going to be censured. So I guess one can see why, how difficult this is. But how do you interpret something like this in which lawmakers don't want to talk about, which is clearly the biggest issue happening in our day?
Yeah, well, I think it's not surprising that you're seeing this kind of behavior from members of Congress, even members of Congress who you might consider normally part of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. It's a fraught moment for politicians. It's very easy, of course, to condemn Hamas, and in particular, to condemn the attack on Israel. And I think we all should. It was clearly an example of war crimes, quite horrific in lots of different ways. That's easy to do and not particularly politically controversial. It shouldn't be, at least. The problem is that if you also want to criticize how Israel is responding to that, whether they are also violating international law in their response, or if you want to say that there is a prior history here that helps explain, not justify, but explain what's been going on there, that's politically much more dangerous, because there are well-organized interest groups that support a intimate, sort of unconditional, unqualified American support for Israel, and they will try to make anyone who criticizes Israel pay a political price for it. So there's no upside for most politicians to express criticism for both sides at this moment, and therefore you're seeing, I think, a fair number of people try to stay out of the news, not get forced to take a position, and certainly not forced to defend that position in public.
There is a history of consequences for lawmakers who are critical of Israel in the handling of Palestine.
Yeah, and a number of prominent cases in the past, Charles Percy, Paul Finley, some others, And those are object lessons for other politicians, but they don't necessarily even need those object lessons. I mean, it's, I think, well understood, and we're seeing it, as you mentioned, happen now, that if you're perceived by groups like AIPAC and others as not being sufficiently supportive, not being anti-Israel, just not being sufficiently supportive, there's some greater possibility that you're going to face a primary challenge, that campaign contributions will flow towards your opponents and away from you. You'll get people writing letters to local newspapers, criticizing your stance. It's just going to be a headache. And for most congressmen and senators, the last thing you want is to magnify the number of headaches you have to deal with. And there's no comparable set of groups on the other side. It's not as though you might face criticism from one, but you have equally politically potent support that you're now winning from this. So again, for people in Congress who don't have a strong personal view on this, the sort of smart political calculation is to just go along with the consensus, keep quiet, vote for the resolutions, and move on to something else. And I think that's what we're seeing. And it's unfortunate because it means it's you don't get serious debates about these issues within Congress. You don't get pressure on the administration from Congress to rethink its own positions. And what you then get in the Middle East is this recurring cycle of the same thing happening over and over and over again, as we are tragically witnessing now.
Do you think the dynamic of the two sides is changing? It does seem like public opinion is starting to change on the issue when it comes to Israel and Palestine.
Yeah, I think there's no question that there's been shifts over time. I mean, first of all, there's a much more open discussion of these issues. More information from a wider range of opinions is available. I think that's partly the internet, partly the sort of what you might call the democratization of media in a certain respect. It also is because just there are more sources, people with cell phones, people with cameras can load up videos and things like that. So that's partly it, and more voices raising questions. I think also the collapse of the two-state solution, the sense that the Israeli occupation is not temporary but is in fact permanent, that's contributed to a shifting view of Israel. The rightward shift in Israeli politics itself, especially vivid in the last couple of years, but actually going on for a long time, has made it harder for Americans to see the two countries as tightly linked by the similar political system, two fellow democracies and things like that. And then finally, I think you see a change in demography in the United States, where support for Israel, sort of reflexive support for the underdog that you might have seen in the 50s and 60s, even in the 70s, is just not nearly as apparent, especially among younger people, including many American Jews who see Israel's conduct and in particular its treatment of the Palestinians as inconsistent with their own values, the values they were raised with. All of those things, I think, have shifted the image of Israel in the United States in important ways. What it hasn't done yet is shift American policy positions in any kind of substantial way. And that'll take, I think, even more time.
So Congress is behind the public at large?
That's right. Congress, and I would also even the executive branch as well.
What is the U.S. interest in being such a staunch supporter of Israel as it is?
Well, my view is that it's not in America's interest to be as uncritical and unqualified a supporter as we have been, that the United States ought to have a more normal relationship. We would support Israel's existence. We would defend Israel if its survival were ever in jeopardy. But we would also distance ourselves from Israel if it was doing things that we thought were wrong. We would use the leverage at our disposal to try and bring about a genuine peace settlement. And in fact, what we argued back in our book, 15 or so years ago, was that this relationship of unconditional support, one that was largely due to the political influence of groups like AIPAC and others, was harmful for U.S. interests, but also harmful for Israel as well. It was perpetuating an untenable situation that was going to cause Israel enormous problems down the road, that failure to resolve the issue with the Palestinians was going to be a permanent headache and was going to get worse and worse and worse. And I think, you know, again, the horrible Hamas attacks are evidence of that, not, again, to justify them at all. But that's the kind of thing that that worried us. So we would be better off if the United States had a normal relationship, if we could have worked to achieve a two-state solution back 15, 20 years ago by putting pressure on both sides, not just on the Palestinians, which is effectively what we did, and put this problem finally to rest a while ago. Now, I think it's very difficult to see sort of an easy path forward, given how far things have gone.
So why do you think the United States hasn't done that then? Why do you think the United States thinks it's in its interest to fully support?
Well, I'm not sure the United States does, but again, politicians in the executive branch, you know, in the White House.
Yeah, better put. Why do politicians do this?
It's in their interest. And again, largely because they have been worried about the political influence of groups like AIPAC and others, and the consequence, the political consequences, if they are seen as being overly critical of Israel. You know, Jimmy Carter faced enormous pressure as he was trying to bring about the Camp David agreements and the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty. George H.W. Bush, Bush 41, who did put some very modest pressure on Israel back in 1991 and 92 over some loan guarantees, faced a firestorm of criticism for that. And Barack Obama, you know, who genuinely, I think, you know, was a supporter of Israel, who was really eager to try and achieve a two-state solution, faced pressure, including pressure from other prominent Democrats to go easy, not press Israel on settlement building. And ultimately, what many of these politicians do is they have to make some choices. In Obama's case, you know, he basically had to make the choice: can I push for a Middle East peace agreement early on in my first term, or can I get Obamacare through? I have to decide, and he ultimately decided that Obamacare was more important to him. That if he pushed Netanyahu any harder, he was going to lose some support from other, from members of Congress, including Democrats in Congress. He wouldn't get Obamacare through, and you know, his presidency would be a failure. So part of it is politicians making calculations of what kind of political price they're willing to pay to do what they probably know is the right thing to do in terms of foreign policy, but it comes with a big political price here at home.
Earlier, you said it was a horrible attack that Hamas did on October 7th. I'm assuming you're condemning it. You might have even said that.
No question. I mean, the killing of civilians is never permissible, and deliberate killing of civilians in particular, and the heinous way in which it was done was I think something that should horrify all of us. And I have trouble understanding why people can't instantly see that as worthy of condemnation.
And we've had people on with different views on that very issue. Sure. My own view is just my sense of my own humanity requires me to condemn that attack. But that also requires me, and this is something I heard you talk about in an interview as I was preparing for our conversation that you did with Al Jazeera just a few days after the October 7th attack. If I'm going to condemn Hamas's attack on October 7th, then I also need to look in the mirror. And I think we all need to look in the mirror, because we'd all stop talking about Gaza, stop talking about Palestine. In Israel, they have moved on from, seemingly, I'm not in Israel, but seemingly it moved on from the issue of Palestine. They were involved in a huge political struggle there, but it had nothing to do with Palestine.
Yeah, I think that's right. And you know, a few weeks ago, I wrote a long piece about the various things that the United States had done that contributed to the broader sort of environment and set of political developments, really going back in some cases 20 or 30 years, that led to this situation. And you know, as soon as you say things like that, there are some who will say, well, wait, you're justifying what Hamas did. No, you're not. You're trying to understand where this comes from, even if you think the actual response was unjustified and worthy of censure and criticism. And the fact is, you know, since the end of the Cold War, the United States has been the major power most intimately involved in what's going on in the Middle East. We've really kind of had a monopoly on trying to shape political, military, diplomatic events in that region. We monopolized the peace process from Camp David, from the Oslo Accords forward. We were going to be in charge. We were going to mediate. And various presidents, you know, Clinton, Bush, Obama, all tried to do that, and they all failed. They all said, we want a two-state solution. And despite the United States being the sole superpower, they failed to get across the finish line there. The United States organized a peace conference back in 1991, and we excluded Iran from it. We said, no, Iran has no business coming to a peace conference on the future Middle Eastern order. And that led Iran to start building ties with Hamas. Basically, it was their way of saying, you can't exclude us. We have ways of causing trouble for you if you try to drive us out. So that's in part where Hamas becomes more powerful over time. And then to bring it rapidly up to date, beginning with the Trump administration and the so-called Abraham Accords, which the Biden administration, for all intents and purposes, embraced, people decided the Palestinian issue was too tough, too hard to solve, and we're just going to put it off to one side. And instead, we'll work on normalizing relations between Israel and the Gulf states, and especially Saudi Arabia. It's clear the Biden administration was pushing very hard to do that. Now, I don't think that was as much directed for Israel's sake as it was attempts to retain our influence in Saudi Arabia. That's something else we could talk about. But the point is, they had decided, along with the Israelis and along with some others, including other Arab countries, that the Palestinian problem could be put over to one side and ignored. And what Hamas did, and I think this was part of their motivation, was basically to remind the world that this problem had not been resolved, that the fate of 10 million plus Palestinians could not be ignored. And they put it themselves, of course, right back in the headlines by doing this, this, you know, to me, again, a criminal act. But it was a reminder that attempting to pretend that the Palestinians no longer existed or no longer had any agency whatsoever was not going to work.
The issue of terrorism, and when we say terrorism, oftentimes it just sort of seems like we're talking about monsters and that come out of nowhere. But when I think of terrorism, I think of it as actually a violent political act. I think back to the movie, The Battle of Algiers, where I sort of really learned this, and that is an act of terrorism oftentimes, and there are different situations for different times, but oftentimes is an act by a weaker force, usually on a soft target, a civilian target, that is heinous, that is terrible, that even the people that they say they represent disapprove of, and nobody likes it, but it causes that more powerful force then to overreact, and its overreaction, it then makes life miserable for everyone else that ends up then uniting folks against that power. And to me, that kind of is what the purpose of terrorism is.
Yeah, I think you've summarized it actually very nicely. I mean, terrorism is simply a tactic, right? We tend to use this label. They're a terrorist as if though that's a statement of their essence or their whole being. But in fact, terrorism, the attack on civilians for purposes of sowing terror, attracting attention, provoking an overreaction by whoever you're ultimate target is, those are simply tactics that a whole wide variety of political groups have used. And it is, as you said, usually a weapon of the weak. I mean, if you were strong enough to accomplish your political aims directly without having to attack civilians, without having to engage in these sorts of activities, you'd do that. That's a more straightforward way of trying to accomplish it. And so it is very much tends to be a weapon of the weak. And as I said, it's groups, you know, the Irish Republican Army. Before the founding of the State of Israel, there were Jewish terrorist groups who were attacking the British colonial power or mandatory power in Palestine at the time because they were weak and had no other way of dealing with the British as well. That was controversial, by the way, in Zionist circles, whether or not those groups were behaving legitimately as well. So there was lots of debates within the Zionist movement on the use of that tactic. But the point is, such groups did exist. And some members of those groups ultimately became prominent politicians, prime ministers in subsequent State of Israel. So terrorism is, unfortunately, a tactic that groups will use to try and advance their political aims. Doesn't mean it shouldn't be condemned, but it needs to be understood. And in particular, one has to always ask, what is the political problem here that has to be resolved in order to prevent this from happening again, from continuing to occur? And that's, I think, what unfortunately we're now being reminded of with the current conflict in Gaza.
Does that bring an opportunity to deal with this now? I mean, obviously, it's a terrible moment. Over 8,000 people in Palestine have died. We expect thousands more will still die here in the days ahead. I mean, this dwarfs what happened back in 2014.
Yeah. One would like to hope that this is a moment where, you know, parties on all sides, in the United States, in Israel, in the Arab world, among the Palestinians as well, will take a deep breath and consider their positions. Have we been pursuing this in the right way? Have we been thinking imaginatively enough about how we try and solve this problem? We have, millions of people on both sides attempting to cohabit in some sense the same space. And how are we going to do that? So I'd like to think that you're going to see, a sort of everyone having a moment where, a moment of clarity where they begin to reconsider some of their positions. And, you can't rule that out. But one of the tragic paradoxes here is that at moments where that might be most necessary, like the one we're in, also tends to be when it's most difficult. Passions are exercised here. Politicians are nervous about their own positions and defensive. The desire for vengeance and revenge is present on both sides as well. So we would like to see cooler heads prevail, but it's sort of hard to expect that to happen. And most important, and this I think the part that troubles me the most, is it's very hard to see right now exactly what a solution might be, right? You could talk 25 years ago about a two-state solution as being a meaningful possibility, not that hard to pull off, not easy, but not beyond the realm of possibility. And I think now it's much harder to imagine that being achieved relatively quickly. The number of settlements in the West Bank has grown, so that creating a viable Palestinian state is much harder now than it used to be.
Why is that?
Because the Israelis have systematically not only increased the number of settlers, I think it's well over 700,000 or so now, but also carved up various parts of the West Bank with roads and checkpoints and a variety of other things. So if you're imagining a Palestinian state that's a real state, that's territorially contiguous, not just a bunch of interconnected bantustans, that's much harder to do now. And I believe that was sort of a deliberate move by various Israeli governments to make this difficult.
Does that include, if you look at a map, and forgive me, I'll give you a chance to get back into your thought, sure. but I just really want to understand this. If you look at a map, the West Bank and Gaza are separated. Is that what you're... Is that part of it?
No, that's a further problem, that the West Bank and Gaza are separated. But I'm talking about the West Bank itself. That if you look at maps of the various peace proposals that have been discussed, one of the obstacles, one of the objections the Palestinians had is that this wasn't a contiguous state, not just the separation between the West Bank and Gaza, but even the West Bank was going to be divided in different ways, with Israel having control over access back and forth between all of them. There were other limits there. You could imagine that happening back then, much harder to do now. And plus the fact that the political and demographic trends in Israel have been moving in the wrong direction. If a two-state solution is what you want. The sort of far right Orthodox and ultra Orthodox population has been growing in number, much higher birth rates as well. The fact that Netanyahu now leads the most right-wing coalition in Israel's history is a further obstacle, as some of the people in that coalition are completely uncompromising on this. The Israeli peace camp, which in the 90s was fairly formidable, by and large doesn't exist. And the Palestinian Authority, not Hamas, the Palestinian Authority, which is supposedly the party we're supposed to be dealing with here, has been sort of systematically weakened by its own internal divisions and corruption, and I think by some Israeli efforts as well to sort of prevent it from having any real power. So even if you got up tomorrow morning and said, all right, we're going to go back to a two-state solution, that's what we've learned. We've got to get there. It's a much longer and harder problem to deal with, a longer road to travel than it was 20 years ago. And we failed 20 years ago or more as well. So again, it's right now, it's hard to be very optimistic about where this is headed.
And what's the alternative, a one-state solution?
Well, then people start talking about alternatives. So a one-state solution, maybe some kind of federal system, federation, et cetera, is certainly one option conceptually. And by the way, a one-state solution where Israeli Jews and Palestinians are all part of the same state, they all have equal rights, they all vote in elections, et cetera, that's consistent with American values, right? A good state with, you know, one person, one vote, et cetera. That would be a very sort of American-like solution. The problem there is, you know, binational states don't have a great track record. There are often very deep divisions, and especially given the century or so of conflict between, you know, Jews and Arabs in Palestine. So you can sort of imagine this lovely platonic ideal of a state, but as a practical matter, I don't think it's a very attractive option anytime soon. So that's one option, but again, I don't think it's a great one. The second option, if we're just thinking out loud here, is, you know, ethnic cleansing, right? You solve the problem by expelling the rest of the Palestinians. And of course, that's a crime against humanity. And nobody, it seems to me, can really be supportive of that, regardless of, you know, your which side you tend to favor. And for reason, and the third option, of course, is essentially permanent apartheid, that Israel controls all the West Bank. Palestinians have no political rights there. Israel retains de facto control over Gaza, as it has for the past, 20 plus years or so. And that just goes on forever. I don't think that's a particularly attractive outcome either. And we're seeing today what the consequences of trying to make that work are. So there were four options, right? Two-state solution, one-state solution, ethnic cleansing, or permanent apartheid. And that's why I used to always favor the two-state solution. Not perfect, hard to get there, but the best of the set of alternatives. Once you take that one off the table, then you're left with a series of really horrible options here. And that's one of the reasons it's hard to be very optimistic about where we are today.
Both terms, ethnic cleansing and what you called permanent apartheid, are terms that are being used today, and Israel's being accused of both. You said permanent apartheid. Would you consider what's happening now to be apartheid?
Well, that's the situation. Yeah, I mean, certainly the condition in the West Bank is one of apartheid, as separate legal systems, denial of political rights, use of the various instruments of state power to keep a population suppressed. And, you know, this is the position that, you know, Human Rights Watch, a respected international human rights organization, B'Tselem, which is a very respected Israeli human rights organization, is also labeled this an apartheid situation. You know, prominent South African politicians, from Bishop Tutu to others, have when they saw this, they said, you know, this looks familiar to us, not identical. There are some differences, obviously, from the South Africa situation. But that's, you know, obviously a very loaded political term, but it is an accurate description of the situation that exists on the West Bank.
Another allegation that's being made by some is that Israel is committing genocide. You mentioned ethnic cleansing. do you think genocide is happening?
I don't. I wouldn't use the word genocide. I think I have a fairly high bar. It's a a horrific act and needs to be condemned when it occurs. But it's also a term that now gets thrown around a lot. So I don't think there is a systematic campaign of genocide. That is to say, an effort to utterly eradicate the Palestinian people undertaken by Israel. I think we're even sort of short of what you might, some social scientists would call examples of a mass killing, although we could probably argue about that. What I do think you're seeing is a disproportionate response to what happened on October 7th. I think we're seeing indiscriminate attacks in which inadequate care is being taken to protect civilian life. So in that sense, I think we're seeing violations of laws of war and international humanitarian law, but I don't think it's a genocide.
And finally, how do you read Joe Biden's handling of this moment?
I think Joe hasn't handled this particularly well. I think what they have tried to do is, respond the way most American politicians would respond immediately, the full embrace of Israel. And then as the consequences of that full embrace become clearer, they're starting to back off a little bit. I think they begin to recognize that this stance of ours is not playing well in much of the world. It may be good in terms of domestic politics, but it doesn't help American diplomacy anywhere else. Certainly, how we can be so critical of Russia's occupation of Ukraine and so tolerant of Israel's occupation of the West Bank for many years is not lost on people sort of outside the United States as well. And unfortunately, I think Biden and Blinken and the people around them are still sort of trapped in an obsolete view of Israel and Israel's relationship to the United States, and that they think the appropriate relationship is this relationship of unconditional support. And I think we're increasingly entering an era where we don't want to be hostile to Israel, but we want to have a more measured relationship towards Israel. And that would actually be better for Americans and also better for Israel in the long run.
Part of me wondered, and I could be wrong on this, but I think of Joe Biden, somebody who for many years was chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And I wondered if he was trying to play this in a way of he had at the very beginning to show 100% support to Israel. Now, we're right. We're going to put our warships nearby to protect you from other countries striking you. And we are here with you 100%. He had to do that in order to be able to, and I don't mean to downplay what has already happened, more than 8,000 people have died, probably many, many more still to come, regrettably. But he had to do that in order to be able to try to slow walk what was going to happen afterwards. And maybe
I think that's certainly the most charitable interpretation you could take, that there is a kind of strategy here that if you had begun by, sort of coming in a heavy-handed way, the Israelis would have dug their heels in. And I think one of Biden's great strengths as a human being and as a politician is a sense of personal empathy, right? Even some of his opponents politically talk about what a fundamentally decent person he is. I think his life story is endemic of that. And it's quite clear that his attitudes towards Israel have been informed by that throughout his life. It's not just sort of political pressures that he, I think, felt powerful sympathy for the plight of the Jewish people in the aftermath of the Holocaust, strong support for Israel as a safe haven for Jews as well. And I think that you didn't need AIPAC to get Biden to sort of empathize and sympathize. And that's the part where I think, that instinct has some value, but it also may blind him to the need for a different course, at least part of the time. Where I think, you know, I think I said this in something I wrote a couple of weeks ago, that the Biden team is actually remarkably good at solving problems that they helped create. We're trying to address problems that, that they helped create. They are skilled mechanics. They're skilled practitioners of policy work. So once a problem arises, they know how to push the buttons and turn the levers and get things to happen to try and resolve it. But we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that we got this problem in part because they had like everybody else, had ignored the Palestinian problem since they took office. They had decided it had gone away, didn't need to be worried about. They were pursuing the normalization between Israel and Saudi Arabia. They weren't really doing anything to protest against what the Netanyahu government was doing on the West Bank, the increasing attacks on Palestinians by settlers and things like that. We were largely silent about all of that. So having been asleep at the switch for, you know, 2 to 3 years, they suddenly woke up with a problem they didn't expect, totally surprised by it, and now have had to sort of improvise a solution. And unfortunately, I think that also describes their handling of a number of other problems around the world, sort of better at crisis management than actually developing a sort of long-term strategy that will leave us in a better place.
It seemed like with the war in Ukraine, new international lines were being drawn, China seemingly backing Russia, the global South seemingly being more sympathetic towards Russia. Do you see the conflict in the Middle East now in Palestine and in Israel? Do you see that as a part of this larger dynamic that's happening globally?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think that much of our attention at the moment should be focusing on the situation there and trying to end the suffering and hopefully, move the political process onto a more constructive track. But if you then step back and ask what the long-term implications here, I think that this is not going to be helpful to America's global position, not going to be helpful to our diplomacy going forward, precisely because we are taking a position and have adopted a position that is at odds with what many people around the world, including people in Europe as well, regard as inconsistent with our professed values, inconsistent with what we claim to stand for, and in many respects, hypocritical. And just, you know, think of how the Chinese are going to spin this in various places around the world. They're going to say, look, the United States has been running the Middle East or trying to run the Middle East for 30 or 40 years, pretty much on its own. And what do we get for that? We get a disastrous war in Iraq. We get Iran closer to a nuclear weapon. We get another disastrous intervention in Libya. We have a prolonged civil war in Syria that's very destructive. And now we have this horrible bloodletting between Hamas and Israel. This is what happens, ladies and gentlemen, if you let the United States run some part of the world or try to do that. And so the Chinese then say to everyone else, maybe it's time to share power in the world. Maybe we need a more multipolar world, one where the United States is not so dominant. My suspicion is that that argument is going to attract a lot of sympathetic listeners in other parts of the world, and that's going to make American foreign policy a tougher thing to manage going forward, you know, once this immediate crisis is behind us.
Stephen Walt has been our guest again, professor of international relations at Harvard University. Stephen Walt, thank you so much for taking this time.
Nice talking with you, Mitch.
That does it for Letters on Politics, a show